This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between, and they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino.
We should dismantle the fact that Indigenous peoples are seen as research subjects and areas of expertise rather than the scientists and experts themselves.
From Futuro Media and PRX, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, Jessica Hernandez on why we need Indigenous environmental science. For Jessica Hernandez, becoming an environmental scientist seemed like the most natural thing in the world. She had grown up learning about animals and plants from her grandmother in Oaxaca, in southern Mexico. She loved going fishing with her father, where she always seemed to learn something new. Jessica felt that she already had so much to share with other people who were interested in the environment. But when she started studying marine science, things weren't so simple all of a sudden. As an Indigenous immigrant woman at a university in the United States, the knowledge she brought to the classroom was mocked or dismissed. Her professors had no interest in what she, and by extension her family and her community, had to say. Still, Jessica knew that she belonged any place where the environment was being discussed. Not just for her love of nature, but because she had seen how being shut out of the conversation had been so harmful to her Zapotec and Maya Chorti communities. So she finished her degree, but didn't stop there. She got a master's and then a PhD in environmental and forestry sciences. She learned the formulas and specialized terms used in academia, and she confirmed what she had always known, that what her grandmother and father had taught her was also a form of science. Now Jessica has collected her family's stories, historical accounts, and other case studies in the book Fresh Banana Leaves, Healing Indigenous Landscapes Through Indigenous Science. She hopes it's going to change the way we think about environmental science. In her own words, here's the story of Dr. Jessica Hernandez.
My name is Jessica Hernandez, and I'm from the Maya Chorti and Zapotec nations of El Salvador and Oaxaca, Mexico. I'm an Indigenous environmental scientist. I currently hold a position at the University of Washington, Bato, where I teach Introduction to Climate Science. I also conduct research on environmental physics of climate science. And I wrote a book entitled Fresh Banana Leaves, Healing Indigenous Landscapes Through Indigenous Science. One of my fondest memories is just being able to go visit my grandmother in Oaxaca, Mexico. And she just taught me a lot about our environments. She liked to go walking when she was able to walk. And she would just teach me about the landscape, the mangoes, and also about the animals. My dad loved fishing, and because he was a fisherman, that's how he was able to sustain his family in El Salvador, because he was the eldest and he used to fish. And I think that I always thought my dad was like really smart, because like if we went fishing, he didn't need a rod, right? Like he could make his own rod out of the materials that he could find. He could make fish nets also, and I always thought that that was really cool. And I noticed that when I was like in elementary school, my dad was learning how to read with me. And that always made me question like, oh, my dad is learning? Like, what does that mean? But my dad sharing that journey with me as I was learning how to read kind of inspired me to be like, oh, if my dad is like doing this with me, maybe I should, you know, look into school. And I think that that's what motivated me to love education, because my parents had been denied education and they instilled in me like, oh, you know, if you can get an education, go for it. Being introduced to the environment from the lens of my grandmother and my father, it kind of fostered that interest in me to want to learn more about our environment. I always noticed how my communities and my relatives back in my ancestral lands were always dismissed, right? Like if they wanted to advocate for something in the environment, they would be like, oh, esos indios no saben, like they don't know anything. They're, you know, ignorant. Like, what are they talking about? And I think that that's something that my grandmother instilled in me, because she was like, oh, you have the opportunity to pursue education. Even my parents, right? Like my dad didn't get any Western education, right? Because he was busy as a child trying to support his family after his father passed away. So he never stepped foot in a classroom. And I guess it would be my naiveness, because I thought, you know, like, oh, I could bring in my family's teachings into the curriculum. I could bring it to the professors. They're going to really accept it. But when I went into the classrooms, oftentimes, you know, I was ridiculed by professors because there would be like, oh, you need to cite this. You know, you need to go towards peer review articles. Or, you know, is this Jessica's theory? Where is this information coming from? When I would share testimonies or lived experiences that will hint towards the topic we were discussing, but because it wasn't published or it didn't have any scientific credibility, it was like dismissed and oftentimes ridiculed by my professors, right? Even as a graduate student, I had to sit in classrooms while they were laughing. Like I had just like said a joke or something and I was like, okay. But that just shows you how professors, you know, especially white scientists can be dismissive towards indigenous peoples, right? And that was me, somebody who had privilege to be in that classes. So I could just imagine how they would treat our communities if they went to our communities and they would share all these stories as well, right? They'll probably laugh as well. To see how they were very dismissive kind of like made me understand that, you know, what I had envisioned environmental sciences to be as a field wasn't necessarily what it was going to be. The sciences have the lowest diverse populations of students and even professors. I don't recall an indigenous professor throughout my undergraduate. So even in my graduate degree, like if I wanted to work with an indigenous professor, I had to go to like the Department of American Indian Studies or the Department of Ethnic Studies, but it wasn't necessarily within the College of the Environment or the Departments of the Environments. But my grandmother always told me, like, if you can learn how the colonizers, so you know, the gringos speak, you can help us advocate for our environments, right? Because now, like, they're not going to dismiss our way of knowing because we can use that Western terminology. Personally, I prefer to use the term indigenous science as opposed to traditional ecological knowledge, because oftentimes I think that traditional ecological knowledge has this connotation that it's knowledge that no longer exists, or that it's kind of like traditional in the sense that it belongs in a museum as opposed to it's alive and has adapted over the years. Our knowledge systems are a form of science. If anything, they're like the longest living science on planet Earth, because it has been kind of created or passed down through generations. It has also adapted as our environments adapted, because, you know, our indigenous science that probably our great grandparents had is not the same that, you know, we have, because our environments have drastically changed because of climate change, urbanization, and everything that colonialism introduced to our lands. And I think that one of my biggest push is that indigenous peoples are scientists, and that oftentimes we're told, because we live in under these settler frameworks, that we have to obtain degrees for our knowledge to be validated. But, you know, all of indigenous peoples who have that knowledge to steward their lands, to co-manage their resources with their entire community, tribes, or pueblos, hold on to that science that is the foundation of our existence and resistance. They might not be peer-reviewed or published as much as, you know, the Western sciences, but it holds as much credibility as the Western sciences do. I was always interested in trying to write a book that voiced my father's story, especially his story as a child soldier who fought in the Civil War. And I think that once I was able to get him to sit down and tell me his whole story, it kind of like sparked an interest for me to write it. I wanted to be able to share his story, but I also wanted to be able to tie in the stories of my mother, my grandmother, my aunts, my relatives, my community members, and other people that I'm in community with, so that we can amplify how Indigenous rights, even if we're talking about immigration rights, are all interconnected to our environment. Through the book, I weave different scenarios or case studies of communities who have led that movement. And hopefully that also shows people and the readers that, you know, it is something that they can support instead of co-opting or stealing. Because that also tends to happen, right, in the Western framework where people are like, oh, that's a great idea. Let me go steal it and name it something else and then pretend I'm the founder, when it's like Indigenous knowledges that were shared to certain people and then they take that ownership. One of the examples that I can give is permaculture. So permaculture is this like holistic way of doing agriculture where you're not necessarily putting much labor into the agricultural system, but the agricultural system is sustaining itself. And when you look at the history of permaculture, it was founded, you know, and I quote that, founded by a white man who went to Australia and learned from some Aborigine communities. And permaculture then became this like really expensive certificate that you can get. That's one of the critiques that I make in the book on how we should dismantle the fact that Indigenous peoples are seen as research subjects and areas of expertise rather than the scientists and experts themselves, even without degrees. There's a lot of research articles written about the Zapotec community, but when I have asked people in my community, oh, did you know this and that, you know, that was written about our community, they're like, oh, I had never heard that. So that shows you how many of the times Indigenous peoples are used as the research subjects and not the research experts. I'm really careful with like not sharing any medicinal remedies or sacred knowledge, because it's kind of hard, right? Because you don't know who to trust. And I think that being exposed to all these stories of co-optation or knowledge theft made me a little bit more guarded on the knowledge I would share. So I feel like I always walk the fine line of sharing my Indigenous knowledge with other people, because, you know, it can either be co-opted, stolen, or also invalidated or dismissed. What I want readers to take away from this book is to learn more about the Indigenous movements that are happening across the Americas, because oftentimes we fail to recognize how our certain identities contribute to settler colonialism back in Latin America. In the United States, we focus more on being oppressed because we are oppressed as people of color. But when we go back to Latin America, it's Afro-Indigenous, Black and Indigenous peoples who are oppressed by, you know, some of us. And I think that hopefully that brings a new perspective to the whole narrative of the oppressed and the oppressor, and how we can work together to undo that. One of the things that I talk about in the book is that conservation is a Western construct, because in our languages, like if I were to try to translate conservation to the Zapotec language or the Maya Chorti language or other languages that many Indigenous people speak, there is no word that directly translates to conservation. Most of the words that kind of tie or are interconnected to conservation focus more on protection, like protecting our environment. Most of the words in our languages hint towards healing rather than, you know, like conserving. Is not only that it cannot be directly translated to our languages, but sometimes it comes in conflict with a way of life. And oftentimes, in the name of conservation, there is this oppression used against Indigenous peoples, especially when it comes to their inherited right to have access to certain natural resources. And we see that in national parks. When national parks were created, it was under this framework to conserve the natural pristine wilderness, when in reality, there was a lot of Indigenous communities who lived in those lands that are now national parks that were exploited, oppressed, and kind of removed from their ancestral lands. And I think that it kind of shows the nuances that need to be discussed in the national park system, because a lot of these monuments have names of violent people that perpetrated that violence against indigenous communities that were violently ripped off or removed from their lands. So the project that I conducted for my dissertation was to indigenize restoration in Discovery Park, located in Seattle, Washington. It's the largest urban park in the state of Washington. And that's an interesting park because it has a really beautiful indigenous history behind it. I decided to use my PhD to try to restore and heal some of those 20 acres of land. But in that way, what I decided to do was to amplify and center the indigenous ways of healing our earth. And one of the teachings that our elders were able to, you know, teach us to practice was that under Western conservation, invasive species, they're like known as pests or weeds. But for indigenous communities, we should see them as displaced relatives, because there are someone's relatives that have been displaced, like many of us have. I got in a lot of fights with the Seattle Parks and Recreation Department because, you know, even the way that they wanted us to take care of the weeds was different than the way we were told to take care of the weeds by our elders. Because, you know, for them, it's like they're weeds. They just have to be removed versus, you know, us. We will do prayers and we will ask for their permission to leave, you know, the land so that native species can come back in. So it was a lot of, like, I wouldn't say like really bad conflict, but a lot of like fights with Seattle Parks because of the way that we practice restoration wasn't aligned to their, you know, rule book. One of the interesting metaphors that I use in the book is that banana trees are invasive to Central America, yet we have embraced them as our relatives, right? And I think that that's a metaphor that I use for my lived experiences and the lived experiences of many displaced indigenous peoples, that as banana trees, we have also been displaced from our ancestral lands, yet we adapt to our environments. And in this case, you know, sometimes we're welcome into those environments. Like in the case of banana trees, like, you know, in Central America, they have been used in our traditional foods to make our tamales, plátanos. We, you know, we fry them, yet they're displaced relatives, right? They're not native species. They come from Southeast Asia, but they were introduced. And I think like banana trees displace indigenous peoples. We are forced to adapt to our new environments. And hopefully, you know, for some of us, we're working to become welcome into those new environments. One of the teachings that my grandma always told me was that anywhere I walked that wasn't my land, I was an unwelcome guest, right? Because it was like we're going into other people's homes. And those other people are the indigenous peoples whose lands we're walking on. And I think that one of the things that she always told me to think about was, how do you become a welcome guest, right? Because I have to still navigate that as a displaced indigenous woman. And the same way that I want people to form those relationships with my communities once they're in Oaxaca. One of the beauties of being an indigenous instructor, especially in the college setting, is that I can support other indigenous students. I want to inspire students to find that sense of belonging, because like I always crave to have an indigenous professor teaching me about the environmental sciences, but I never got that. In a way, sometimes I question like, oh, do I really want to become a professor, go for 10 years? But then I think about my younger self and I think about that 18-year-old who craved that indigenous professor that she could approach after class and talk to them, right? And I think that being an indigenous instructor now kind of allows me to cater to those students.
This episode was produced by Victoria Estrada and edited by Julio Ricardo Varela. It was mixed by Gabriela Baez. The Latino USA team includes Andrea Lopez Cruzado, Marta Martinez, Daisy Contreras, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Patricia Zulbarán, Ginny Montalvo, Alejandra Salazar, Reinaldo Leaños Jr., and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our supervising senior engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Our assistant senior engineer is Julia Caruso. Our associate engineer is JJ Carubin. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our fellows are Elisa Baena, Monica Morales, and Andrew Viñales. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. In the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Acuérdate, no te vayas. And I'll see you soon. Ciao.
Funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Latino USA is made possible in part by California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians, and the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't know that. Okay. So the title of the book is Fresh Banana Leaves, Healing Indigenous Landscapes Through Indigenous Science.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple.